Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 49.
On this week's show, we talked to Mr. Adam German from realestate.co.jp about what is required to rent an apartment here in Japan. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about getting an apartment and getting a job here in Japan. Not two of the most interesting topics, but unless you are looking for a job and looking for an apartment, then maybe they are the most interesting. But two of the things that are very necessary when you first arrive here in Japan. And what's kind of interesting actually is getting a job and getting an apartment can be either really easy or really challenging depending on how you go about it. And let me explain. The easy route is if you get a job overseas. You got a job from your home country. Either a school has sponsored you or a company has sponsored you, and you arrive in Japan and you've already got your job. And typically, those situations will also arrange for your apartment. So you get to Japan, you got your job, and they hand you the keys to your apartment, and everything was really well done. Those are the people that you always meet, and they're like, yeah, everything in Japan was so easy and so great. I just showed up, and they handed me my key and paperwork, and everything was perfect. And we hate those people. Just kidding. The other side is how I did it, is when you show up with no job and no apartment, and you try to figure everything out yourself, and that is the more challenging one because everything here is done completely different than what I expected and how it's done back in the West. And trying to figure out the rules as you're going along can be quite a bit challenging. So on today's show, I'm going to be talking to Mr. Adam German from Real Estate Japan, who's going to walk us through the steps that are required to getting an apartment here in Japan. Before we get to Adam, I quickly wanted to talk about getting a job here in Japan. As some of you may or may not know, I am currently under contract with Gaijin Pot, and Gaijin Pot runs the largest English language job board here in Japan. So this isn't strictly a plug for my company, but chances are if you've come to Japan, you don't have a job, or you do have a job and you're looking to upgrade or get into a new line of work, you would have used our services on our job board. And I wanted to take the time to introduce a new section of the job page that we're going to be launching. It's called a resource page, and on this page is going to list all the articles and video and interviews all about working here in Japan, far more than I can go into this podcast right now. I've got a bunch of articles that I've put together, everything from resume writing tips to how to do a Japanese interview, some of the cultural aspects of working in Japan. We've got some really great video interviews with some of the insiders in this industry. I did an interview with a gentleman who's one of the top recruiters here, and he actually goes through and points out what he looks for in a resume. Because think about it, many times when you write your resume, you think it looks good, but you don't really know what the recruiter is looking for, right? So, but now after watching this video, you will get to see what he looks at when he looks at a resume. And it's actually very interesting because some of the things he talks about, I didn't even realize it myself. So if you watch that video, it'll give you a good insight into what he looks for, and then you can go adjust your own resume. So I'm really excited about this new job section that's launching on Gaijin Pod. I think it'll be a tremendous help for anyone here in Japan who's looking to change careers or improve their career. You can find that on the Gaijin Pot website under their jobs tab. If you click on the job tab at the top, and under that you'll see a resources link. Just click on resources and you will find all the articles and all the video, and I'll post a link to that from my website at tokyopodcast.com. One of the first big challenges that you may face when moving to Japan is finding an apartment. The idea of simply showing up and forking over some money and getting the keys is not exactly done here. getting an apartment is a complicated process that involves many traditional Japanese laws, weird acronyms, and a lot of fees. To help us understand this process, I'm pleased to welcome to the show Mr. Adam German from the website Real Estate Japan. Real Estate Japan offers one of the largest listings of Japanese properties, both for sale and for rent, as well as numerous articles and guides on Japanese housing market. Hey, Adam, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Now, I recently went through the housing rental process, and it was quite confusing, and I'm actually going through it again, unfortunately. And I wanted to kind of go through today some of the steps and challenges that people will go through when they start to rent an apartment here, because it's not an easy process, is it?
No, it's not, especially if you don't have any information to go on at the very beginning of the search. Even if you walk into a real estate agent's office, the service that you're bound to see is not going to be what you're expecting. So it's always best to kind of go in prepared, and really finding that information is the biggest challenge. Yeah.
Right. You know, one of the biggest mistakes I made when I came here was, I was staying in a hotel, and, I just assumed that I would find a place, give a deposit, and I'd be able to move in immediately. And I didn't realize that the application process alone takes about a week or so.
That's right. It's a lot more complicated here, and that's mainly because of the tenant laws. This is what a lot of people don't realize. The tenant laws in Japan are very much favored on the tenant rather than the landlord. So basically, once you're in an apartment and a lease agreement has been signed, then you're in. It's very difficult for landlords to kick tenants out. It will take, if a situation happens where a landlord would like a tenant to be kicked out, it will take probably, the entire process will take about between 6 to 9 months.
Hmm.
And that whole time, the tenant is living in the place without paying rent. So landlords want to be very, very sure that the person they're renting to is the least of a risk as possible. And that's why you have such a really complicated application procedure.
Right. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, let's start at the top then. One of the first challenges that I saw was language.
Yes.
Where I come from in Bangkok, many of the apartments that cater to foreigners, English was widely spoken. But I noticed here, you see these real estate offices all over the place with their billboards outside, with all the pictures of apartments everywhere. But many of them don't speak English, and so that's kind of a first barrier, isn't it, in getting an apartment?
Exactly, and there's a rumor out that basically says that, okay, there's a lot of no gaijin apartments, basically kind of perpetuating the myth that there's only the Japanese-only buildings, no gaijin are allowed. Actually, where that myth stems from is exactly like what you said. Mr. Smith walks into Mr. Suzuki's real estate agency, and he tries to get an apartment. Now, Mr. Suzuki cannot speak a word of English, so the only thing that he can utter out is "no gaijin."
Right.
And what he means is that it's not that, you know, there's no gaijin allowed in anything that I've got. What he means is I as an agent am not capable of handling a foreign client.
Right.
And yes, there's lots of agents around, but it's very hard pressed to find one that speaks English. This is where we had kind of come up with the idea for Real Estate Japan and our site, realestate.co.jp, to make it a one-stop digital place for foreign people and English speakers right now in Japan to look for apartments.
Right. And I think that, you know, when I was searching for apartments, many of the landlords would always ask me, do I speak Japanese? They were always very concerned about that. And I think that it isn't a racism issue, which some people tend to think it is, but it's more of a safety and a communication issue. They want to know that in case there's an earthquake or in case there's an emergency, they can contact you and be able to communicate effectively.
You're exactly right. And I mean, think of what I always said. We used to be agents ourselves, and what I used to say to clients on this one was, because it's true, is that, look, imagine you own a building wherever you're from, in an English-speaking country, Canada, America, Australia, or whatever, and you've got some guy who's Vietnamese who wants to rent your place, you want to know if he speaks English because of that very reason. In case there's the building's on fire and someone's knocking on the door, you know, you're speaking English, the tenant doesn't understand what you're saying,
right,
but you're trying to scream at him, get out, the building's on fire.
Right.
And, you know, the tenant doesn't understand why you're being woken up at that time. So for emergency situations, it's a very, very big concern because you as the owner of that building do have a responsibility to make sure that you can do every reasonable effort to assure the safety of your tenants.
Right. And, it is a big concern here in light of all the earthquakes that Japan has. I remember when I moved in, the gas guy came and he spent 10 minutes showing me how to turn off my gas in case there's an earthquake and a gas line breaks. I mean, that's a serious problem that could cause a big fire. And if I don't know how to do it, if I can't read the instructions, then, it could cause a lot of problems for a lot of other people.
Exactly. And I mean, not even the earthquake, but even just, you smell gas in your apartment. How do you shut it off? I mean, it's the way you do it here shutting gas off all over the world is just a valve. But where that valve is, usually what the meter looks like, that's what's unique to Japan, for example.
Right.
And it's that kind of safety that not only the owner, but you're right, the utility companies have to explain as well. So this is where the question of can the foreign tenant speak any Japanese at all? It doesn't even have to be fluent, but as long as it's like everyday conversational, or in Japanese, as you say, Nichijō Kaiwa, if you can do that level, then 90% of the landlords are okay with that. Yeah.
And on your website, the agents and the real estate companies that have listed through your websites, most of them can handle English. They have English speakers?
Every single one of them can, and we're working with over 80 agents right now nationwide. The bulk of them are in Tokyo, but we do have agents in Osaka and Nagoya.
Right.
And we're trying to expand that out. That's our never-ending mission, basically, to cover the whole country, to offer English speakers options no matter where they want to live.
Right.
So, be it Hokkaido, be it Okinawa, we're trying to expand that. Right now is the major metropolitan areas.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Great. And then the next thing that I think many people might find a little bit confusing is some of the acronyms that are used to describe the apartments. I know when I first started, agents would ask me, what do you want? Do you want a 1LDK, a 2LDK? And I had no idea what an LDK or what that is. I'm coming from Canada. We're like, I want two bedrooms and a bathroom.
Yep.
And then they ask me, like, do you want your bathroom and your shower in the same room or separate? And I'm like, I didn't even know that was an option.
it very much is. I mean, it depends on the size. But yes, LDK is living, dining, kitchen. And what that refers to is basically the main room of where you're living, be it a house or be it a condominium, be it an apartment. It's basically the communal area. Now, if you're from a Western country and you're used to having the kitchen in a separate room, that's an architectural difference that is different here. Is usually the kitchen and the living room are always the same room.
Right.
It's this big open space.
Right.
And living, dining, kitchen, that's exactly what it means. Now, you'll see some other places that just have DK and dining kitchen, which basically refers to a living, dining, kitchen without the living. So it's a smaller communal area. And you're right, the number denotes the number of separate rooms off of the communal area.
So, for example, like a one-bedroom apartment, that would be equivalent of a 1LDK here?
That's correct. A four-bedroom apartment or a four-bedroom house would also be included as a 4LDK.
Right. And then what we would consider a studio back home would be a 1DK.
No, you would consider that either a one room or a 1K.
Okay, so 1R, I've seen that.
Yep.
And that 1K.
That's right. It's not until you get into a 1DK or a 1LDK where you're starting to see off the communal area a separate private room.
Right. Okay.
If it's a 1R or 1K, that equals studio apartment.
Right. Okay. Okay. And then the other thing that confused me was when they would ask me what size room I want, and they would quote the size in tatami size.
Yes.
Now, what's that? What's a tatami size?
Yeah, a tatami is a square rectangular mat. I'm sorry, a rectangular mat that is used as a unit of, traditionally used as a unit of measurement in Japan. And tatami is a grass mat that is tightly woven together that made up the flooring of traditional Japanese homes. If you're from North America, then you're used to hearing sizes in square feet, and if you're from Europe, it's in square meters. But basically, one jo or one tatami mat is 1.53 square meters.
So one tatami, and referred to here as jo, so one jo, ichijo, yep. I guess they would say, right?
That's right.
Is about 1.5 square meters or 16 square feet. Now, in the average room, how many tatami would there be?
For it depends on the size. It depends on the size. If it's a smaller place, then you're looking at even the smaller studios. The smallest studio should have about between 5 and 6 tatami mats of space. And then when you start getting into the bigger spaces, then you'll tend to see a 10 mat or even a 15 mat space with about 5 or 6 mats for each separate room.
Right. Okay.
Right. So if you're looking at it, to put it simply, if you're looking at a 4-bedroom, then each bedroom would be about 5 or 6 mats, tatami mats, and the communal space will be between like 10 and 15.
Right. And so someone looking to rent, maybe they're in Europe right now, they're in North America, and they haven't been to Japan yet. Typically, the people would use the tatami room for sleeping. Is that right?
They would use the tatami room for sleeping. Other people use it for a home office. Really, it's important to denote that it doesn't necessarily, even though the apartment or the house on the floor plan is measured in jo or tatami mats, it doesn't mean that there are tatami mats on the flooring. It could be hardwood floor or carpet. It's just, like I say, a unit of measurement.
Okay.
A traditional unit of measurement, yeah. It's best to think of it as a room. Now, they generally tend to be designed for bedrooms. They have closets in there. But you can use it for anything you like, really.
Okay. Yep. So, and the average I've seen is about 5 or 6. So if you can think about 6 tatami is about just under 10 square meters and just under 100 square feet. So that kind of gives you an idea of what the size of that room will be.
Exactly. Yep.
Great. And now the next thing that was a bit of a challenge was the hoshonin, or known as the guarantor.
The guarantor. That's one of Japan's most unique things. And the ironic part of it is that everybody needs a guarantor, even Japanese people, but no one wants to be one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I found it ironic that in a country that seems to avoid all risk, you have to ask someone to take a risk.
That's the irony of it all, yeah. And and actually, what they are is they are, just as the name kind of alludes to, is that you're the signer of the lease. You're the tenant is the main signer of the lease, but also the guarantor is there in case anything happens to the tenant, where the landlord can go and have someone else who's legally responsible for paying the rent and that apartment. In case something happens to the tenant. Now, when talking about foreign people, the obvious part is foreign people have the option to just up and leave Japan on a day's notice, right? If they want. Japanese people can't, but still, even for both foreign and Japanese people, the guarantor system is in place. And that's the hardest part, even with Japanese people. For Japanese people, it tends to be family members.
Right.
Dad or mom will usually be a guarantor. But the important thing is that not anybody can be a guarantor. They've got to pass the inspection of the apartment, or I'm sorry, the application process of the apartment, the exact same way as the person who wants to live there.
Wow. Does the guarantor have to be a Japanese person?
Yes, must have Japanese citizenship.
Right. So if you're a foreigner coming here, you can't say, "Don't worry, my uncle back home is loaded. He'll take care of me." That's not going to work.
Absolutely not. They must be a Japanese person. There are some people that say, some property managers will say, it can be another foreign person as long as they're in Japan and they have what's called a permanent residency visa.
Right.
In theory, it works. I've never, ever in practice found a property manager and an owner comfortable with that.
Okay.
So it's, yes, to put it simply, it must be a Japanese person living in Japan.
Have you ever heard of people using their credit card as a guarantor? I read somewhere briefly that it was possible that if you give them your credit card.
Nope. There are some newer operations that are catering toward the foreign clientele in Japan, offering high quality shared housing.
Right.
That will allow that. But if you're looking for your own apartment on par with a Japanese person, never. The closest thing that it comes to with that is you might be able to pay your deposits and your initial first month's rent and all your contract fees,
right,
with a credit card, and then thereafter pay your rent off your credit card.
Right.
But it is not a guarantor. It is not in lieu of a guarantor, no.
Okay. So for someone coming here then for the first time and they don't know anybody here, they don't have a guarantor, what is their option?
There's another option called a guarantor company. And this is an insurance that acts in lieu of a human guarantor. And it adds a half month's rent to the contract fees, but it's a very good fee if you don't have a guarantor, and it's become very popular even with Japanese people too. And basically, what happens there is if something happens to the tenant, where the tenant leaves, or it's a long hospitalization, or some reason, then this guarantor company kicks in and takes care of all the back fees and takes care of putting the unit back to its original condition.
Okay. And does this guarantor fee have to be paid every year?
It's paid per contract. So usually lease contracts in Japan are 2 years.
Right.
And the fee, the half month's fee covers the length of the contract.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a fee payable. To put simply, it's a fee that's payable every 2 years.
Right. Okay. And typically, the real estate agent will have a guarantor company that they work with. Is that right?
It actually is not the agent, but the owner.
The owner. Okay.
Yep. The guarantor company is an insurance that is aligned with the owner of the property.
Okay. But it's not like you have to go find one yourself.
No. What you would say to the agent that's capable of handling your inquiry in English is that I don't have a guarantor, but I want to use a guarantor company.
Right.
And then that agent will then turn around and source properties and with that fact in mind that this client must use a guarantor company.
And typically, what are the requirements that the guarantor company look for?
Very good question. It's actually the same requirements that the property manager is looking for and the owner are looking for. And my best advice to people who are new to Japan is you want to basically figure out your budget first. And to figure out your budget to pass an inspection, you want the rent of the apartment that you're planning on applying for to be no more than 1/3 of your monthly income. Put it simply, if you make 300,000 yen a month, then you are only looking for your maximum budget for apartment rentals is 100,000 yen. With that in mind, then you go to your agent and say, this is my budget and I need a guarantor company. And then off you go, going and looking at places. When you find one that you want to apply for, you have to be able to prove that you make 300,000 a month. And that's basically your letter of employment from your company with salary information, your alien registration card, which is actually being phased out as of July 9th. And I'm not really sure exactly what the next requirement will be. But up until now, it's been letter of employment from your company, alien registration card copies, and copy of your passport and visa. That's what you need for a normal apartment inspection, application, sorry. Right. And the guarantor company requires the exact same documentation. So in this sense, you're hitting two birds with one stone.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And actually, you mentioned visa. It was kind of interesting that I found out that some guarantor companies will refuse you based on your visa. So if you're trying to apply with a tourist visa, for example, which is usually only a few months, and you're telling them like, you know, hey, don't worry about it. I'm going to get a job. I'm going to get a work visa. They may not want to take that risk.
You're absolutely right. Japan is actually backwards. You need the job first.
Right.
You need the job first so that you can then go and try and secure a longer term lease in an apartment.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So for people new thinking of coming to Japan, yes, it has to be a working visa.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then let's move into the fun part, which is the fees.
Yes.
Now, this was a bit of an eye opener when I came here. I was surprised at how much I had to pay up front.
It is an eyeful. If you're coming from a country where it's first and last month's rent,
right?
Then and maybe a deposit, then this is going to be an eye opener because even typically with all the fees that Japan is traditionally known for, put together, you're looking at 6 months from day one,
right?
Just to sign the contract and get the keys.
Right.
Now that's the maximum. And the fees you're talking about, you have deposits, which are usually 2 months.
Well, let's break it down here. There's one fee here that I hadn't heard before, and I haven't experienced this myself, and it's the reservation fee. What's it called? Tetsu Kekin? Is that still common?
Are you referring to key money?
No, the reservation fee. Tetsu Kekin?
The reservation fees are usually more along the lines of if you're looking for something that allows short-term stays, anything less than 2 years.
Ah, okay, okay.
It is and it isn't, depending on the company.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, older companies tend to still have that fee, but a lot of the new companies now don't.
Okay, so then the first fee is obviously the deposit, shikiken, right?
That's correct.
And typically that's about 1 to 3 months.
1 to 3 months, typically two. And you can expect to get it all back in theory, minus a cleaning fee. Right. And for each square meter, is usually about between 1,000 to 1,500 yen.
Right.
Depending on the property manager and the cleaning company that they're using. Outside of that cleaning fee, you should, in theory, expect to get it all back, but there's stories out there where you get none of it back. So,
Right. Up to the landlord, I guess.
It's very – when you're going into a contract, a leasing contract, that's something you want to do at the very beginning, is to really detail with your property manager or your real estate agent exactly what will be taking off that deposit and how much you can expect back, assuming the place is in a decent condition when you leave.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I found that in my experience, and you know, getting that deposit feedback, it's never been a bit of a problem. But I have heard horror stories as well that some landlords are really meticulous about the condition of the apartment,
and they can take advantage of the situation. I don't really want to name names, but there's a couple companies out there that I've consistently heard stories from. For example, the wallpaper. I mean, there's like a one small tiny nick in the wallpaper.
Right.
And the tenant is being charged to re-wallpaper the entire wall.
Right, right.
And even that's if there's a scratch. And then I've even heard a story where someone had like a small pen mark that couldn't come out, and it was a white wall, and they got to pay for the whole wall to be re-wallpapered again. So there are some really – you want to make sure, again – with your property manager and your real estate agent, exactly what is going to happen to the deposits, what gets penalized, who's responsible for what before you sign the contract.
Right. And the cleaning fee, is that paid over and above the deposit, or is it taken out of the deposit?
That's taken out of the deposit.
Okay. Okay. Yep. And this cleaning fee is not not minor. I've seen some of the places I've talked to, I mean, it was up as high as $300. Which seems kind of a lot to me to clean a small Japanese apartment.
You've really got to watch that. Like I said, it's usually should only be between 1,000 to 1,500 yen per square meter. So if you've got a 30 square meter apartment, then yes, it would run into that. If you're talking to a shared housing unit that you've only got a very small unit, and they're charging you that same amount of money for a cleaning fee,
right,
then something's up and you want to go and talk to them about that. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So then let's move on to the one that causes probably the most angst among foreigners, and that's the reikin, the key money.
Yes. This has a sordid history. This is something – actually, earlier I mentioned that the tenant laws are very much on the tenant side.
Right.
That never always used to be the case. Post-World War II, you had actually a huge shortage of housing all over Japan. I mean, the place was firebombed, right?
Right.
And the only landlords who had anything left had people lining up out the door to be able to live there. And this is where key money was born. So basically, it's a bribe that has somehow found its way into tradition.
Right.
And so what had happened was, I mean, if you were an owner back then, key money, they put a nice name on it, daikin. And if you look at the kanji, dei means, you know, politeness, you know, and bow.
Right.
And kin is money.
Right.
So it's
polite money.
Polite money, which is basically it has no purpose. It's non-refundable. Even with Japanese people, it's slowly making its way out of the system, but not fast enough. If you were a landlord back then with the only house standing for miles, and you've got a lineup of people who want to live there, to separate them, basically, it was like, okay, who's going to pay the most key money?
Right. Right.
And that created a situation where, as rebuilding happened, then everybody kind of took that on. And where the tenant laws had kind of come in was, I mean, landlords would, you know, okay, I just got 3 months key money from Tetto Suzuki in November. But in January, 3 months later, he's a little late because he's having trouble finding work. Fine, he's turfed because there's another lineup. There's a whole horde of people that are willing to pay me another 3 months just to secure the place.
Right.
So it got rampant, basically.
Right.
This is where the tenant laws came in to protect the tenant in a big way. But for some reason, key money still stuck around.
Huh.
And it's slowly dying off, but not fast enough. But this is basically gift money, and it serves no purpose other than a bribe.
And typically, it's what, 1 month's rent?
One or two, actually.
One or two, okay.
Yeah, one or two. And this is another thing on our site that we're trying to do is we're really trying to keep out the key money. We're working with agents to basically say, look, foreign people do not like key money.
Right.
You won't get anybody paying key money, don't post any properties on our site with key money. And for the by and large, the majority of our listings are key money free.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Great. And but the thing I also heard with key money though is that some landlords, instead of charging key money, will just up the rent a bit. So in the long term, it may be actually cheaper to pay the key money up front and secure a lower rental place.
Very excellent point. It that does happen. Something that has no key money has the rent raised basically over a 2-year contract to pay the key money.
Right. So I think for so many foreigners, I think when they hear that key money, the idea of it kind of goes against their own thinking. So they immediately discount all the properties that have key money. But yes, if they would just take a split second and kind of calculate it out, many times paying that key money up front can get you a 2-year apartment at a much lower rate. So it's something to consider when you're looking at apartments.
If you know that you're going to live here long term.
Right, right.
If you think, and long term meaning 2 years at minimum,
right?
If you think you're only going to be here for a year, then it is absolutely not wise to pay key money,
right?
If you know you're going to be here for 10 years, then you can think of it that way, yeah. Right. Over the long term, you end up paying the same amount as if you paid key money at the front of when you signed the contract. But again, it all depends on how long you foresee yourself being here. And if it's under 2 years, then no key money places for sure.
Right, right. Okay, yep. Great. And then the other fee is the agent fee.
Yes, the agent fee, yep.
And that's usually about 1 month's rent as well?
1.05, and the 0.5 is to include consumption tax.
Okay, okay.
Yep. This fee is really dependent on how well your real estate agent helped you. And it is payable. It is necessary. It's another endangered species of a fee, actually, because there's some agents that are doing it for – traditionally, it's 1.05 months, but then now that you see agents out there working at
52.5%,
right, just cutting it in half, basically.
Right.
And then other agents are working at zero agency fee. Those last two are in the minority. Mm. The majority of agents are still charging 1.05 month of key money. And really, but I'll tell you, if you can find an agent that listens to you, that listens to your needs in an efficient way, that shows you properties that are spot on, this can be an agreeable fee to pay.
Right.
But it really depends on your boots on the ground service. Now, it's important to remember that your agent might not represent the property manager or the landlord of the building you want to apply for.
Right.
That agency fee is mainly to pay. It's a brokerage fee.
Right.
And in Japan, you have an MLS system that is only a multi-listing system that is only available to agents. So when you walk into an agency, what they will do is they won't look on their own books and see what properties they have themselves. What they'll do is they'll go into this closed multi-listing service for agents only, start searching your criteria and seeing what comes up, and then showing you apartments that way. So what they're showing you is not their own apartment. And all the money that you need to put down to secure an apartment, if there's an agency fee involved, then 90% of the time, the only thing that your realtor is getting out of this, out of doing all this work for you, is just that agency fee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, and it's basically just a brokerage position.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And this is what I mean. It can be a very, it can be a very agreeable fee depending on how well your real estate agent listened to you and made you feel welcome and listened to what your requests were and found places that matched it. Hmm. Or it can feel like it's a complete waste of money because the agent you were working with, you didn't give you that feeling that you were being listened to and all that sort of stuff. So whether or not that's a good thing to pay or not really is up to whoever you're talking to.
I think for many people who are, getting here for the first time, especially I think the language presents a big barrier. So, yeah. Paying an agency fee, I think is worth it, to help smooth things over. And I mean, even so small things like trying to find location. I remember when I was looking for apartments online, I remember being asked, like, what train line do you want to live near? And I had no idea. I had like no clue what the train systems were. But I could tell my agent, look, I'm going to school here. I'm working at this office here. This is the address. Find something around this area. And they would know what train lines kind of go through that area and how far away they were.
Exactly. You want to be close. You want to be as close as possible to work. And that's usually enough information for an agent to be able to narrow down which train lines. Other things that you'd want to think about, too, is, okay, I want to be within 30 minutes of work, station to station.
Right.
What's your acceptable morning commute? Around your apartment, your future apartment, what do you want to have? Do you want a shopping mall? Do you want parks? Do you want quiet? Do you want, you know, all these things you should think about before talking to an agent. Yeah.
Right. And they can help smooth all that over. Tokyo is such a large city that I think having an agent and paying that fee, like you said, if they can, you know, take care of all those problems for you, is well worth it.
If it's done in an efficient manner and you get a guy who isn't trying to take advantage of you, isn't trying to take advantage of your ignorance of the local area, and a guy who educates you about, okay, this is good because, you know, there's a supermarket like really close by. It's a really nice area of town. You know, you'll have a lot of fun there. If you like clubbing, then, you know, this area is good. If you like nature, this area is good. If you've got a guy who's not just there pushing paperwork, but really taking part in your apartment search as if it was his own, that makes the agency fee well worth paying, I think. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So for people listening then, and going back to our example of paying 100,000 yen for your apartment, be prepared to pay upwards of 500,000 to 600,000 yen the day you sign the contract.
Yes, at most. Yep, at most. Now, if you get a zero key money place, then you take 2 months off.
Right. Yeah, okay. So this is assuming you're paying all the fees. You're up around 600,000 yen, which is about 7,500 American dollars.
Yes.
If you can avoid the reikin, the key money, you may be able to knock that down to, say, 400,000, which is about $5,000. So still a pretty big chunk of cash to come up with.
Exactly.
To move into your apartment.
Yes, exactly. And it's not, again, if you're going to come to Japan and you think you're only going to be here for half a year, then walking into a real estate agent's office is not the solution for you.
Right.
Our site, for example, realestate.co.jp, we've got a lot of short-term rentals that are there. They tend to be shared accommodations, though. And shared means common use, kitchen and bath, but with a private bedroom.
Right.
And what you're seeing, though, now is there's a lot of higher end locations that look very, very attractive in that. And I think the shared locations kind of had a bad reputation up until the last 2 or 3 years, I would say, when you started seeing a lot of new companies coming out with better locations and better facilities to cater to this, the under 1 year, the estimated stay for under 1 year market in the foreign category, right? So a lot of options that are out there now. It's on our site. Go ahead and take a look. But yeah, if you want to get into like a condominium type place or an apartment here in Japan, then if you're going to stay for under 1 year, then it might be tough for you.
Okay. So you've paid, you know, your 4 or 5 months of fees up front. You've got your key, you're all excited, and you get to your apartment and you walk in, and what do you find? It's completely unfurnished.
Completely unfurnished and not no fridge, no washer, no oven. It's got a range. It'll be either a gas range or an electric range, but that's about it.
Right. So then you got to open your wallet up again and find furniture.
Find furniture, exactly. That can cost, it just depends on the size of your place and how many people you got and how, what you need to be comfortable. But the basic stuff, if you're going to buy it new, it's going to cost upwards of another, like, you know, between $1,000 to $1,500. The best way to go about it that I've found, is you want to go to recycle shops not just any recycle shops. You want to go to recycle shops that are in the expat areas of Tokyo or Osaka or Nagoya. And the reason for that is you see a lot of expats kind of come and go. But when they go, they don't want to take the fridge. They don't want to take the appliances. But they're still in very, very good condition.
Right.
Buying those used is the best way to save, is to cut that in half.
Right.
But going to the recycle shops in expat areas.
Is it true that you have to pay a fee to dispose of your refrigerator or washer or some of these large appliances?
Yes, that's right. And the fee that you're paying is to the city office to take it away. It's like a special disposal fee.
Right.
Like fridges and anything large, for example, needs a special disposal fee. Air conditioners and fridges, especially too, because they've got the Freon in them.
Right.
And it's not just a matter of Japan has very few garbage dumps. Like what we would think of in Canada. A lot of the stuff is incinerated here.
Right.
And if it's not incinerated, then it's recycled. And if it's not recycled, then it goes to the garbage dumps that do exist. But they're considered much, much smaller than what you'd find in Europe or North America.
Right.
Okay. Or Australia, yeah. Or New Zealand, too.
And another good source that I found for getting actually free furniture is the website called Craigslist. I'm sure many people are familiar with Craigslist. And you will see on there these things called Sayonara Sales.
And they're fantastic. They're wonderful because you've got – if you time it right and you're coming into Japan and looking for all the odds and ends and big appliances that you need to be comfortable, and you time it right where someone who's got a lot of the stuff you need is leaving, you can pick up a lot of this stuff for free, yeah.
Yeah, I did that actually. I managed to really luck out and this lady was leaving Japan – and I practically furnished my entire apartment with her stuff. I mean, and it cost me nothing. I paid the 10,000 yen, Ichiman yen, is that right? Over $100 to have it delivered here.
Yep.
And it was great. I got desks and kitchen stuff and a shelf and everything, all for free, a washer, dryer, microwave, refrigerator, everything. And the delivery people came in, set everything up, and boom, within one afternoon, my apartment was fully furnished. So, but you're right, though, as I did notice on Craigslist, is that nearer to the end of the month, you start to see a lot more of these Sayonara sale postings.
That's right. And one thing, you mentioned it, you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, I got my stuff from one person. That's when the big benefit of a Sayonara sale can happen. Where it can get complicated is if you're buying certain items from different people.
Right.
And it's or receiving different items from certain people, because then it's not just one trip with a truck, for example, or it's not one delivery trip. It can turn into five or six, and that cost can add up.
Right.
So the best way to do it is if you can find one person who's got all the stuff you need and they're dying to get it off their hands.
Right. And that actually is a good point too, because we went shopping at the Nitori Furniture Store, which is close to our place.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought some other larger items from there. Nitori actually offers free delivery on some of their larger items.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at the prices on Nitori and say something is for free, but you're paying five people to deliver it, it actually ends up costing you more to get these free items from Craigslist.
The savings definitely start shrinking, yeah, at that point. Yeah.
So really, you know, shop around and get your calculator out, because sometimes a brand new piece of furniture from Nitori could be cheaper if you get it delivered for free than ordering it from Craigslist.
And a lot less hassle too. I mean,
there's
Nitori here. Nitori is a Japanese name. IKEA is also here too.
Right.
They don't offer free delivery, but right in the IKEA shops, you can go to a little desk that will basically is a delivery counter.
Okay.
You pay right then and there, but you know, it's nothing. I've never heard of anybody paying more than 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 yen.
Right.
And the more they got to ship, obviously the price would go up. But I mean, that's a pretty good budget for shipping if you're going to go to IKEA, say.
Right. And what's the Japanese word for recycle shops?
Recycle shop.
Okay.
It's English with Japanese pronunciation.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. And typically, you know, many people might be thinking of like the old pawn shop in their neighborhood that had the gold chains and the baseball cards and stuff like that. But the ones that I've seen here, the quality of a lot of the items in the recycle shops is really top notch.
You don't – and I think that speaks volumes of Japanese culture itself. I mean, a lot of people will take care of their stuff. And these recycle shops, I mean, it's not like you have a recycle shop specific to foreign goods to Japanese goods. It's whoever's looking to sell their stuff.
Right.
And the majority of them would be Japanese people. It speaks volumes of how well they take care of their things. The quality is top notch. I think if someone says secondhand, it might conjure up images like what you said. Here that is very much not the case.
Right.
What you're looking at is a very workable item that still has a ton of life left to it, and it's still in good condition.
Right. Okay. And then, so once you get your place furnished, is it the responsibility of the tenant or the landlord to get the gas and electric and all that stuff hooked up?
The tenant.
Okay. And then how do they go about doing that?
You will need a Japanese speaker. This cannot be done in English.
Right.
If your real estate agent, the brokerage agent that you're paying your agency fee to, he or she might be able to help out with this, because really it is a very simple procedure if you call in Japanese. But there are three different phone calls to three different utilities. Electricity and water is just simply a phone call. No one has to come out to the unit. Gas, I think you mentioned earlier, gas, someone had to be there. And that explanation actually, someone has to go out to your new unit. You got all your stuff. Actually, you might want to set up the utilities before you go out and buy your stuff. You've got to be there for the gas guy to show up. But very simple procedure. He's in and out in 10 minutes. And you can have it, you know, from phone call to when your gas is turned on, you've got 24 hours. Right. So it's a very fast turnaround time. It's not like you have to call them and wait weeks or anything like that. On the other hand, cable and internet, that you will be waiting weeks for. And why? I have absolutely no idea. But you will be – do not expect to come and get your apartment and then make a phone call and get internet that same day. It's going to be weeks. So what you want to do is as soon as you found out that the owner has approved your application – at that moment, you want to call the cable company, because then it'll take probably another week for you to go and get in there and everything.
Right.
And that minimizes your disconnected downtime.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And for really, it's mind-boggling, because Japan is such a technologically advanced country. However, when it comes to cable and internet, it just takes a mind-boggling amount of time.
Right.
For it to get installed. So,
right.
Yeah. So gas, electricity, water, it's all good. Very quick procedures. Internet, cable, television, very, very, a lot longer than you think.
The benefit, though, in my experience anyways, with my internet, was they actually had an English language hotline. So I could call them. My landlord gave me the number, and I just called them, and then, you know, push 2 for English, and it took about a week, but at least I was able to communicate within English. The gas guy was a bit more of a challenge, because he wanted to walk me through the whole procedure about how to shut it off in case there's an earthquake and if I smell gas and all that kind of stuff. So definitely having an Japanese language speaker with you will make things a lot easier.
Yes, and try not to be too hard on the gas guy. He's actually required by law to do that.
Right.
He's a working guy too, just trying to do it. But the law says that he has to take whoever the tenant is through that procedure.
Right.
And really, it's a procedure well worth understanding.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. So I think that's about it. I think that's all the steps, and then you finally get settled into your Japanese apartment. A little bit more complicated than I think many people anticipate when they first come here.
If you approach it with, you know, your budget and you know roughly where you want to live.
Right.
That can make and you have your paperwork ready too. I mean, the paperwork I mentioned, a letter of employment from your company.
Right.
With salary information included. Both front and back copies of your alien registration card and your visa page and the passport picture page in your passport. If you've got this stuff like ready in hand, it can be a much smoother process.
Right.
Than trying to look at apartments and then scramble around for the paperwork at the same time.
Right.
And that would be the best advice I would give to somebody is really get that paperwork together first. Then start opening doors and looking at units. Because when you find something that you want to apply on, if you've got the paperwork ready, it can happen very quickly.
Right.
If you don't, then I mean, someone else might take the apartment while you're running around getting your paperwork ready. So,
yeah.
Which then puts you back at square one.
Right.
Yep.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Adam. I really appreciate you coming on the show. If people want to find out more information about real estate in Japan, or you want to search through listings or read many of the articles they have on their website, visit realestate.co.jp. And thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Anthony, thanks for giving us the chance to come on and help your listeners out. Hopefully they enjoyed it, and hopefully there was some good information for them. Yeah.
Thanks again to Adam German for coming on the show and giving us an insight into the myriad of fees, bureaucracy, and tatami mats here in Japan in regards to getting an apartment. It probably sounds more complicated than it actually is. The thing I find about Japan is that there's a procedure for everything here. And if you can kind of fall into that procedure, then things go smoothly. But the challenge that many foreigners have is trying to figure out what that procedure is. And usually we're kind of out of the loop, and that's where we encounter difficulties. I actually think the most useful phrase to learn when you first move to Japan is, what is the procedure for blank? Because that's the first step you need to figure out. So getting your apartment is no different. Hopefully this podcast will be able to help you. Actually, look for some more video from Adam and I and in the upcoming months. He mentioned something really briefly about these shared apartments. And these things are actually extremely interesting because you would not believe the quality of some of these shared apartments. When I first heard about shared apartments, actually people had recommended it to me before I came here. And I thought, you know, my days of having a roommate and living in a dormitory are long over. And so I wasn't interested in them at all. But actually, in the last couple of months, I've gone and checked out a few and they are amazing. Some of these look like penthouses. And the rent is quite reasonable, and they offer a lot of other advantages for both Japanese people and foreigners. So what Adam and I are going to do is we're going to go around Tokyo and film some of these, so it gives you an idea of what they look like. And we're also going to film some of the other apartments that we mentioned with these weird LDK and all these weird sizes. We're going to make some videos to actually show you guys exactly what these things look like. So keep your eye out on Tokyo Podcast or realestate.co.jp for those videos coming up in the next few months. Well, that's it for me. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.